We are studying the book of Samuel. I'm on page 185. We're at 2 Samuel 23. We're about done with Samuel. Not long ago. Now these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares, and the man who was raised on high declares, the anointed of the God of Jacob and the sweet psalmist of Israel, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God, is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, when the tender green grass springs out of the earth through sunshine after rain. Truly is not my house so with God. For He has made an everlasting covenant with me, and ordered in all things, and secured for all my salvation and all my desire. Will He not indeed make it grow? But the worthless, every one of them, will be thrust away like thorns, because it cannot be taken in hand. It will not be disciplined, will not be confronted. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and shaft of a spear. They will be completely burned with fire in their place. So this is David's last will and testament. His parting words to the world. David, the son of Jesse, declares. David, the one who was raised up to be king, declares. David, the anointed of God and his sweet psalmist, declares. God's Spirit spoke through me and put words in my mouth. The God and Rock of Israel spoke through me. God who rules men rightly, rules in fear of God, is like the morning light when there are no clouds. God is clear and clean and easily seen as being right. We had all these Super Bowl festivities and stuff going on. And what passes for entertainment anymore is it's inane. It's also usually profane. And it just sort of shows where we are. We're like a nation eating the food of the pigs. We just get out there and grovel in the mud and eat and slurp it up and think that our becoming fat is good for us for something other than being prepared to be slaughtered. As we suck down the food of the world, we just prepare ourselves for the execution. And it's a sad thing. We still have some vestiges. They'll sing, Star Spangled Banner. They'll sing America the Beautiful, God Bless America. They'll have a focus on military. They'll have some focus on kids and stuff. So there's still some good stuff there. But then what happens, when they want to party, it's get naked and get, I don't know, it's just profane, that's all. And we've gotten used to it. It's become our daily bread. So, when our heroes are... it used to be that the greatest female singer in the community was Whitney Houston. And the thing about Whitney Houston was she used, at least used to dress right. But now it's Beyonce. And with Beyonce, she must have a really small budget for clothes, because she's got a... And the thing is that I'm sure she's a church-going Baptist or Presbyterian or something, because all these people will tell you they go to church on Sunday, they love the Lord and they're all saved. I was talking to somebody today about somebody in the community who was wanting to help out at MCF. We had a pre-board meeting with the in-town board members, and there was somebody in the community that wants to help out at MCF, and we vet people. What we're really looking for, people have to, if they want to work at a high level, we have a program called an ambassador program. They have to have gone there. That's one of the. But they have to also have. They have to pass. Molly makes them pass certain security tests. He wants to make sure there's no convicted felons there, child molesters, and that sort of thing, because he's had to deal with stuff like that. So, anyway, one of the guys that came up today is a really good friend of mine. He's in one of my Bible studies. and he's wanting to find some way to help out with Molly. He's got a really good heart. And he's also living with his girlfriend. He sits in my classes and he hears me say what you hear me say. And he just smiles. He knows. I mean, it's not like he doesn't know. And I don't pick at him about it. I figure I'm not his conscience. But he'll tell you, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this. You know, but I am. We were in the another group of people we were talking about who are really on fire, young people for the Lord, just really excited about the Lord and whatever. And two of them are living together. They're not married. They don't think a thing of it. And yet, when you talk to them about the Lord, they're just on fire for the Lord. I mean, just really want to serve the Lord and whatever. They have compartmentalized what is their zeal for God, and whatever's in the world is sort of like it doesn't matter. It doesn't count. Now, we've talked about this in class, antinomianism, the whole issue of there are no norms, there are no laws, and whatever you do in the flesh, it's all right. Because it doesn't matter, it's all passing away anyway. The blood of Jesus covers it. And their big blood of Jesus covers stuff. So we have what passes for goodness has been redefined. What passes for godliness has been redefined. Yes, son?
Well, I'm Joe for Katy Perry, and I don't care for Missy Elliott.
Well, I do think she did I thought it was better than it usually is. But it wasn't just that. That's like some of the commercials and stuff like that. But the whole cheerleading squad and all that kind of stuff. I think cheerleading's great, but they ought to have clothes on when they do it, you know. The point is it's intended to sexually stimulate the crowd.
Right.
That's what it's intended for. And we basically say that's just normal. That's the way it is. And our children are buying it. I mean, you know, we talked about syncretism, about putting blending the culture of the enemy in with the culture of the church. And that's where we are. It's not something you run out and you shake a stick at and it goes away. We have to re-educate and re-enculturate people to where they... you've heard me say this before. When I was a young man, after I came out of the seminary and I was real disillusioned, I was a very gutter-mouthed person. You've heard me say this. And I was known for it. I was a coffee house singer, and I was up singing all kinds of ugly, very bad stuff and whatever. And I just felt just righteous as rain about it, you know. But what's happened is in my walk with the Lord, has pulled me back into another place where I wouldn't even think about saying some things. I couldn't even, in a nice way, tell you some of the songs I used to sing. Now, the point is that when I was in that culture, I saw that as good. I saw it as good. And, you know, the whole thing was to be salacious and to be controversial, et cetera, et cetera. But now that the Lord has wrapped me up in his life, you know, I still have plenty of flaws, but my goal is to please and honor God and to, you know, treat people well and whatever. I mean, the whole issue about, you know, people lusting after one another, it's sort of like fair game in our world today. It's sort of like, as long as I don't touch, you know, that's the deal. Jesus had the same issue. He came to the crowd and he said, your leaders have told you that if you haven't committed adultery unless there's, coitus, just to put it nicely. And but he said, I say to you, if you look at a woman with lust, you've committed adultery. They've told you that you haven't committed murder unless there's a dead body. But I say to you, if you call your brother a fool. So Jesus was trying to reinculturate them back into the Torah, which is the basic operating principles of God. You see? So all I'm really saying is that when you look around us, look at the commercials on TV, you know, whatever, or go to an average movie or whatever, what you're seeing is a society that has bought into low-level food, low-level intake, and is showing the signs of it because it's rotting. You know, it's unhealthy. It's less and less healthy. So I didn't mean to get off on a diatribe.
Now, I want to make one more
Please.
About that. Remember how we talk of worse?
Oh, sure. It is getting worse. But
like, you know, what's it? They're really going on, and it's getting worse, but Where is it going?
Well, it's going in the toilet. It's circling the bowl. Yeah, you're saying we judge them and we're just... Part of the problem, Kelly, is we don't think it's wrong. We've come to believe that it's perfectly acceptable. The people I'm talking about who you might say their behaviors are salacious or whatever, many of these actors and whatever, many of those people go to evangelical churches and praise God from the top of their lungs on the weekend, and they're involved in all kinds of things, and they donate money. But they don't see any... They don't see... That's just fashions have changed. And I think there's all kinds of room for that. But it's not necessarily for the worse either. Yeah. See, you can't just be a person that says, if it's not like it used to be in the old days, it's evil. Well, when you say it'll correct itself, why should it correct itself?
Well, that's my wonder. I don't know how that's
going to
happen.
Well, I mean, I'm not talking about evil. Why shouldn't evil correct itself? I'm talking about why should the standards of the old and the standards of the new correct themselves and go back to the old? We can't just be against change. Because there are a lot of things. We no longer think that slavery is right. I'm sure glad we've made that change. But as far as the culture goes, I think the Western culture is swirling the bowl. And I think it's going to take us all down with it. It's already ruined the level of discourse in this country. I mean, the level of discourse in this country is shot. You cannot have a civil conversation. It's always fighting, yelling, screaming, whatever. If you watch a news show, there's no civility. There's no statesman anymore, and that sort of thing. Can that all go back? I suppose it could if we had a real revival. And the reason I suppose it could is because that's the way I used to be. But now I value different things because of my walk in relationship with the Lord. It's changed me so that I value different things. I don't think and act and say things that I used to as just a matter of course. So can there be revival? I think the answer is yes. But I don't think it means I'm going to go back to a vested suit. So,
Wayne, you see that as long as it gets more people into the sanctuary.
That's right. We've got to be relevant. You have to be culturally relevant without being culturally determined. So that's my point. One of the problems we have in this country is we major in externals and blow off the internals. So we're in a big old fight about putting the Ten Commandments up on the wall, but we sure don't want to keep any of them. You know, we want our Christmas, we want our yards full of crutches. We want our post office to have a crutch in front of it every Christmas. But the values of that crutch are no longer part of our values. And we get irate. And I'm not a religious people. We get irate because the symbols of the past godliness are being pushed out of the way by the culture because they find them meaningless. And we go a long way to demonstrating they're right because we push the symbols, but we don't care about what's internal. So, Jesus came and he ate with sinners. Jesus was scandalizing all of his religious leaders because he ate with sinners. Jesus said some pretty ugly things in his sermons that scandalized the religious leaders. They weren't evil, but they were irreligious, and they did not like that. Eat my flesh and drink my body. He lost half his crowd when he said that. Jesus made it clear that the common, ordinary people were closer to God than all these religious uppity-muffs. So I just don't want to confuse. All change is not evil. We may see, like we have, we used to have casual Fridays. Now every day is casual Friday. So I don't want to beat this up, but the point is that we have I think it's where it said God is clear and clean and easily seen as being right. That was the last thing I read that when I got into this. There is a right way to think and a right way to act and a right way to behave that's honorable and decent and whatever. And it doesn't have anything to do with, what's about styles and fashions of the day necessarily, because you can have very, we're all sitting here in a room full of decent clothing, none of which is something you'd ever have worn to church not that long ago. So, I don't want us to, The problem is, it's like jousting at windmills. If you're fighting the wrong enemies, you're missing the point. And if we're talking about the wrong things, we're confusing the audience. So if we say to our, when you say to your daughter or whatever, you know, one ought to dress in such a way as to not be suggestive, appropriate. But to say, you know, I've got these patterns from Gone with the Wind, and I'd like you to pick the one you like the best for your ball gown, that would not be appropriate. Even, but that's how we come across sometimes. Like what we're really interested in is the external. So God is clear and clean and easily seen as being right. Like new growth that comes after the rain when the sun shines, that is how my God is with me and my house. He made an everlasting covenant with me. He orders all the things in my life and makes me secure. He is my salvation. He will make all that I desire come to pass. But worthless men will be cast out with thorns because they cannot be corrected. Whoever deals with them must be armored. They must hold their spear at ready to strike. They will be burnt by dealing with these men. All right. So David has made a testimony, as it were, a statement of his of what God means to him and what God has done in his life and all the things that the Lord has done for him. In spite of the fact that David knows he's not worthy of all of this, one of the things he talks about is worthless men cannot be corrected. He said, you know, they're unwilling to be corrected, and so therefore, you know, God can't be their God. If you talk to them, they're prickly. You know, you'll stab you with, because of the way that they try to defend where they're at. So when we have our ongoing daily prayer conversation with God, one of the things that we should be talking about, one of the things that sort of should come naturally out of us, is a gratitude about all that He has done with us and all that He has brought into our lives and all the changes that He has made. You know, I don't want to be like the Pharisee who stood in the temple and say, "Lord, I thank you that I'm a righteous man," and not like this pig-faced, you know, publican over here. That's not the tone of it. The tone of it is, "Oh Lord, you have blessed my house, and you've caused me to be exceedingly blessed for because of your graciousness and your goodness, because I don't deserve this." You know, I mean, and you know, if there's any goodness in me, Lord, it's because you revealed it to me. We need to be able to walk around and realize that the only difference between us and Beyonce or anybody else out there is revelation. That it was a gift from God, not because we're made of better clay or because we're more responsive people or anything like that. It's because we sought the Lord and He revealed Himself to us. And that should make us just startlingly blessed. And that's what David's doing here. He's saying, you know, and we'll see as we go along here when we get to talking about some of his mightiest men and closest associates. They include Uriah the Hittite, who he slaughtered for the sake of his wife. David knows that he is broken, and he knows that he has violated the laws of God, etc., etc. He knows that he's paying prices even in his ongoing life and in his ancestry because of his behavior, in his descendants, because of his behavior. And yet he says, nonetheless, God has established me and established my house. So he's operating out of this spirit of praise. You know, I have had trouble sleeping in the past. You know that. And I've sometimes gone 2 and 3 days without being able to sleep. And when I lay my head on the pillow and I'm breathing, I thank God for sleep. It just bubbles up in me. Thank you, God, I get to sleep tonight. Every time I lay my head on that pillow, if the machine's working, if I'm breathing, if I don't have to get up and go, you know, wait an hour or a day or a week until I can do it again, you know, I'm just going, thank you, God, for sleep. Thank you, God, for a wife like I've got. You know, thank you, God, for whatever. There's this, I don't want to say this wrong because I don't want to look like I'm self-serving, but there's this explosion out of us of the gratitude we feel for what all God has done for us, and in the midst of us, knowing full well that we don't deserve this, and that there are people all around us who don't have it. Now, we talk about, you know, people we see like on the streets who don't have a place to sleep. They don't have food in their bellies. They don't have clothes for their back, whatever. They don't have shelter, whatever. And we go, look at what they don't have and look at what I've got. I mean, I am so blessed. Well, that's true. But it pales in comparison to the fact that God has revealed himself to us and made us his friend. All of that pales. I mean, all of the money and the home and the shelter and the food and health and all the good things that I have that all these people don't have, that pales in comparison to what God has done for me by showing me who he is. And for you. I'm not saying I'm better than you. And for you. I mean, the fact that you're sitting here tonight because you love the Lord and you want to know, God has blessed you to reveal himself to you in such a way that brings you here. And it's not because you're made of better clay. I wouldn't even do this or even encourage it. But I bet we could go around the room and have a little honesty session and talk about some things that we're not so proud of that we've walked with the Lord and whatever, you know. I mean, maybe several of us. Anyway, the point is the human condition. And if the Lord has caused us to have the grace of God in our lives, it's not because we're more worthy than the next guy. It's because God in his grace has chosen to respond to our feeble attempts to... The Isaiah said about the Messiah when he came that his voice would not be loud and bellicose in the streets. In other words, he wouldn't go around just screaming and shouting, preaching at people or whatever. And it said that he would not put out a smoldering flax or break a bruised reed. Now, what it means is, you know, if you've ever dealt with your candle, and because the wax is built up, it's about ready to go out. It's guttering, they call it. The candle's just about ready to go out, and if you even breathe on it, it'll go out. And what you have to do in order to get it strong again is turn the candle over, pour some wax off, so that it exposes more of the wick, so that it can be strong again. You know what I mean? Well, that's a smoldering flax. That's what that means when... It means that your candle is just smoking because it can't flame anymore. And he said, God, the Messiah, when he comes, would not put out a smoldering flax. And if you've ever had a fern and it's got a little bruise on it somewhere, you know that if you handle that thing at all, it's going to bend where that bruise is, and it's going to break off. And so he said he would not break a bruised reed. What he's saying is that God encourages the slightest attempts that we make toward him and handles them gently. He, you know, it's like if you've ever been on a cookout and you're down to your last, match or whatever, and you've got this wood stacked up here and all that sort of thing. If this one doesn't work, you're going to eat cold beans or something, you know. You get a little bit something going, and you have to kind of breathe, but you can't breathe too hard. God is he's encouraged the slightest bit of goodness in us, and what we do or don't do is respond or not respond. Many of us can look back, I can, and see that God was trying to encourage the goodness in me back when I was uninterested in hearing him. When he was trying to lead me going past. You know, God started me off in a very good and godly home that taught me a lot of things. That's his total grace. Why was I born in a God-fearing household when somebody else was, you know, born in whatever they were born in? I'll tell you another place where it occurs to me. And I think this is part of why I feel so strongly about this, is I spent so much time in Africa. I'm the last person in the world who ever thought he would go to Africa, ever. It was never my intention. I told Nancy, I'm never going to go to Africa. I'll send the $3,000 it takes to go over there, and that'll feed a lot of people. It's stupid for me to go. And I was sitting in the 8 o'clock service one Sunday morning, and I heard the Lord say to me, I want you to go to Africa. And I looked over at Nancy, and I said, God wants me to go to Africa. She went, okay. So I went. And because my logical thinking said it's a waste of money for me to take a $1,600 plane ticket or $2,000 plane ticket, go over there and, you know, spend all this money just to go see somebody else's poverty. It gains me nothing, and the money is better spent for them. But what the Lord showed me is that I benefited from seeing. I benefited greatly from seeing. And what I saw is people who have nothing, but their relationship with God is towering. It's towering. We had this yard man who worked around the compound that we were in Swaziland. He had nothing. I'd been to his house. He lived in a village that had kind of a one-room brick thing with a thatched roof over it. Which meant he was upper class. So So at any rate, we invited him to have lunch with us one day. And so we sat down and I said to him, you know, Isaac, would you like to pray? And he said, oh, I would. And he stood up. So we stood up. And he sat there and talked to God like a guy who just found water in the desert. And it was kind of like, oh, great God, and provider of all that we have and everything. And we thank you for this food and whatever. You know, his sense of who he was and who God was to him was so much bigger than mine. And yet he had so little. And I sensed that all around me. A lot of these people were starving and whatever. Some of these old go-go's, for instance, who were raising... They'd raised their daughters had all died of AIDS. They were raising their granddaughters, and they were raising five or six of them, and they had no Social Security. They were out begging food to feed these kids and whatever. But they were godly women. Well, David is speaking out of a deep sense of gratitude, almost an awe of what all God has done with him. At the end of the day, these are his last words. No, not before he ticked off, but this is his last written communication about all of this. He might have lived for another 2 months after this, I don't know. But at the end of the day, he's going, when I look back at my life and who I am and what I was, and the humble beginnings that I had, and I see how God met me in the fields with these sheep, and which no one valued. Everybody thought it was just my silly poetry phase, you know. And my silly guitar. And when I met the Lord there and we had developed this conversation, this relationship, and he encouraged me to believe, and he encouraged me to that he was with me. And then he brought me before the giant, and he encouraged me to think that I could do this. And then he guided the rock. And then he lifted me up before the king. And then he caused me to be a man of valor at war. And he pulled skill out of me I didn't know I had. I was raised as a shepherd. And now I'm, you know, killing people by the hundreds in battle or whatever. And he said, and then he lifted my house up from that lowliness so that I would become the king. And the king over all these people. And it wasn't as if I deserved it all. If you, in spite of all of the egregious things that I did, God in his grace and mercy responded to me like that. He's overflowing. I think the passage has merit there. And he said, it was, God enabled me to be correctable. And that made all the difference. Because those who are uncorrectable will be worthless men cast out with thorns. And anybody who deals with them had better be armored up, because they will, if you try to help them, they will just stab you back and whatever. In 2 Samuel 23, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Now, these are, if you're looking for names for your grandchildren, okay. Joseph, Bathshebeth, a Tachmonite, chief of the captains. He was also called Adno the Esnite. That's in case Joseph Bathshebeth was not pronounceable for you. He was called Adno the Esnite because of 800 slain by him at one time. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahoite. Dodo didn't mean then what it means to us now. So this guy's name is Dodo, and he has no idea we're sitting here laughing at him because of it. Or his father's name was Dodo.
I wouldn't laugh to his face.
Pardon?
I wouldn't laugh to his face.
That's right, because he just killed 800 people or whatever. That's right. That's right. I would like to introduce you to my friend, one of the great warriors of Israel, Jonathan Buttface. Okay, Jonathan. I think it's Budafachi. Okay, Budafachi. One of the three mighty men with David, when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there to battle, and the men of Israel had withdrawn. You may remember a story about them being in a field of peas or some vegetables or something, and the other people pulled back, and David and these three guys were there, and they stood up against the enemy until the other guys regained their courage. He arose and he struck the Philistines until his hand was weary and clung to the sword. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him, only to strip the slain. So after they'd killed everybody, then the other people came back so they could take all the goodies off the dead bodies. After him was Shema, the son of Agi, a Hararite. And the Philistines were gathered into a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot, and he defended it and struck the Philistines, and the Lord brought about a great victory. So there is, in David's retinue, the three, the 30, and then some others. And we're getting a laundry list of who some of these great people are. David is remembering them here at the end of the day. Then three of the 30 men went down and came to David in harvest time to the cave of Adullam while the troop of the Philistines was camping in the valley of Rephaim. And David was with them in the stronghold while the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David had a craving and said, Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. Bethlehem was David's home city. And the Philistines had overrun it, and probably some of his relatives. And he and his men were surrounding this Bethlehem, trying to figure out how to take it back away from the Philistines, who were well protected behind its walls. And David said, oh, if I could just taste some of the water from the front well. It's of such sweet water, I remember. So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. And he said, be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Shall I drink the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives? David's comment was not meant for them to run off and go get him the well. That would have been water from the well. That would have been very self-serving. He was just commenting that he longed for the sweet water of that he grew up with or whatever. And three of these guys said, well, the king wants water. Let's go get him some water. And when he brought it back, he said, this is too precious. You know, you guys risk your life for this water. It's like drinking your blood. And so he said, he poured it out. He said, I can't drink your blood. Therefore, he would not drink it. These three things, the three mighty men did, these things. In 2 Samuel 23:18, Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief of the 30. So Abishai was not one of the three, but he was chief of the 30. And he swung his spear against 300 and killed them, and had the name as well had a name as well as the three. So he was recognized in the way that the three were recognized. When people said his name, everybody knew him, but he was not as great as these men were. He was most honored of the 30. Therefore, he became their commander. However, he did not attain to the three. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of the valiant men of Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the two sons of Ariel of Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. He killed an Egyptian, an impressive man. Now the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a club and snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah the son of Jehoiada did, and he had a name as well as the three mighty men. He was honored among the 30, but he did not attain to the three. And David appointed him over his guard. Remember, he was head of David's bodyguard. I think all this stuff is explanatory or something. Chapter 23, verse 24. Asahel, the brother of Joab, was among the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehemite, Shama the Herodite, Elikah the Herodite, Helez the Paltite, Ira, the son of Ikish the Tekoite, Abiezer the Anathothite, Mabunai the Hushathite, Zalman the Ahohite, Mahari the Nephathite, Heleb the son of Bianah the Nephathite, Ittai the son of Ribai of Gibeah of the sons of Benjamin, Benaiah a Pirathonite, Hittai, the brooks of Gaish, Abi Alban, the Arbahite, Asmavith, the Barhamite, Eliabah, the Sheolbanite, the sons of Jashan, Jonathan and Shema, the Hararite, Ahiam, the son of Sherar, the Ararite, Eliphelet, the son of Abishai, who was, remember, his cousin, so it was his cousin's son, the son of the Mahakathite, Eliam, the son of Ahithophel, the Gilonite. Remember this? Remember the Ahithophel, who was his counselor? This is his son, is one of David's 30 great men. Hezro, the Carmelite. Remember when David went to get some food from, what was that guy's name? It was the fool. And he ran into, the guy sent his men home with shaved heads or something. And the wife Abigail found out about it and went and, you know, whatever. Well, they were, that's who the Carmelites were. And one of those men who, after this guy's death, he followed after David, became one of his 30. Zelek the Ammonite, this guy is not even a Jew. Naharathi the Berothite, armor bearers of Joab, the sons of Zeruiah, Ira the Ithrite, Gareb the Ithrite, Uriah the Hittite, 37 in all. So Uriah the Hittite, who David had slain to get his wife, was one of his 30. There's actually 37 of them, but they were called the 30. Would you like me to read those names again? Okay. Now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, "Go and number Israel and Judah." Now this is going to be important when we talk about how the Lord operates here. The king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with them, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and register the people that I may know the number of the people." Now you will remember that in the Deuteronomy they were forbidden to number the people unless God called for a census. They were forbidden to number the people because God did not want them thinking of themselves as a great and mighty people because of their strength. What happens when kings get haughty is sometimes they want to say, "How great am I?" And so they go out to number the people, which was forbidden. And David, this was one of his down moments, and he said, "You know, go out and number the people." Joab, who, if you remember, was not the highest ethical person in the world, said to the king, "Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing?" Joab is trying to talk him out of it, because he knows that God doesn't want him to number the people. He said, "I pray that you'll get 100 times this number of people, but why do you insist on wanting to do this thing?" Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commander of the army. So you have to feel like, you know, you're kind of in a bad place when Joab out-ethics you. You know. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan, camped in Aroer. On the right side of the city is in the middle of the valley of Gad toward Jazer. Then they came to Gilead, to the land of Tatim Hadshi. And they came to Dan Jaan, and around to Sidon, and they came to the fortress of Tyre. So they've just described a movement from the eastern side of the Jordan, all the way around to the Mediterranean Sea, Tyre and Sidon. All the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites, they went south to Judah, down to Beersheba, which is the farthest southern community in Israel. Dan Jaan, they were talking about earlier, is the northernmost city in City of Dan, the one they. So when they had gone about through the whole land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. Joab gave the number of registration of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword. The men of Judah were 500,000. So Joab is numbering people sort of in groups, and of the warrior class, this is what he's found. Now, Joab does not report 300,000 Levites and Benjamites for reasons we'll get into here in a minute. Nevertheless, the kings were, this is the Chronicles version. Remember that Samuel's and Chronicles and Kings, they overlap each other. And this is one of the things we'll talk about later, because when we pick what's next to study after we do Song of Solomon, we can continue on with this historical narrative, or we can go on to something altogether different, but just know that it overlaps. You'll run into a lot of the same stories, and some you haven't heard before. Nevertheless, the king's will prevailed against Joab. Therefore, Joab departed, went through all of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and gave David the number of the census and all of Israel, there was 1,100,000 men who drew the sword. And Judah was 470 who drew the sword, but he did not number Levi and Benjamin among them, for the king's command was abhorrent to Joab. So, now David's heart trembled after him that he had numbered the people. He woke up one morning and realized that he had done a bad thing, and something that was expressly forbidden to the kings of Israel. So he said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of thy servant, for I have acted very foolishly." So he wakes up and realizes he's done a stupid thing, done a bad thing, and that he's operating out of his pride. He wants to know just how big he is, you know, whatever. How great of a king is he? And now he wakes up one morning and he realizes this. And so he goes to the Lord and he said, "Please forgive me, because I have acted stupidly, foolishly." When David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer. Nathan was a seer, was a prophet of his. Gad was a prophet of his. Saying, "Go and speak to David. Thus the Lord God says, I am offering you three things. Choose for yourself one of them which I may do to you." So I'm going to give you three punishments. You can choose which one you want. Okay? So Gad came to David and told him and said, "Shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or will you flee 3 months before your foes while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now consider and see what answer I shall return to him who sent me." And David said to Gad, "I am in great distress. Let us now fall in the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall in the hands of man." So as far as being pursued by my enemies, I'll pass on that one. I'd rather fall in the hands of God. So he said, you know, one of these other two, we'll have to pick one of these other two. God gave him three choices, and so he picked one. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. So he got the worst one. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who destroyed the people, "It is enough. Relax your hand." Obviously the pestilence here was a disease of some kind. You know, some sort of a, like measles, or only deadly. David said, you know, let my punishment be one that puts me in the hands of God, because I'm better there than the hands of my enemies. And the Lord did. He said, well, enough's enough. The angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. When David spoke to the Lord, when he saw the angel who was striking down the people, and said, "Behold, it is I who have sinned, it is I who have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done? Please let thy hand be against me and against my father's house." So David said, it's not right that these people should pay the price for my sin. All right. So Gad came to David that day, and he said, "Go up and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite." And David went according to the word of God, just as the Lord had commanded. Now, what should we think about this? We've got David who has done something stupid. The king has done something stupid. He is operating out of a pride, and in the process, he's become sloppy about his walk with the Lord. And it's one of those moments of hubris when he just feels like, you know, what the heck, this would be a good thing. I think this would be good. You know, we should all look at this like as if it's not something we haven't done ourselves. Because we've all, and I shouldn't speak for you all because you're all probably better people than I am, but we've all done something that we really knew we shouldn't, and then later realized that was really the wrong thing to do. And it really speaks to the whole issue of how easily deceived we can be. How if we don't keep our walk with the Lord fresh and daily, that we can drift into doing things. And we can go, man, I wish I hadn't done that, and whatever. So what happens is that David is getting punished. And the punishments that he's offered is that he can flee from an enemy for 3 months, 90 days. Remember Absalom? Remember Saul? You know, he's been there before. And or he can, God will bring a disease or pestilence on the people, or they can have famine in the months for in the Israel. And David said, I'd rather fall in the hands of God. We're better off there. Remember, the people aren't going to be blessed if David has to flee from his enemies for 90 days. Because remember what happened after Absalom? How it took them like several years to get the kingdom back together again? So he said, I'd rather fall in the hands of the Lord. And so the Lord dumped the pestilence on them, and people began to die. What do you think about that?
There's always going to be consequences. We have to have choices made to the Lord. And you don't get a chance to have sticking three, no?
I think we get choices, but that's... Oh, yeah.
Sometimes.
I mean, for instance, you can own up to it and be publicly humiliated, or you can kind of squelch it and live with guilt for, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but it seems to be a little more varied in these cases than choices. But anyway, as this angel's going about doing the will of God, God tells him, okay, that's enough.
God says it's enough.
Enough consequences for
him. Yeah, yeah.
And that is also as a result of him, being...
Well, David is saying it's not fair that these people should suffer what I did.
And so that kind of statements and those kind of things is, I would think that God too.
Yeah. Well, apparently God liked the fact that he stepped up for the sake of the people.
Yeah.
So go ahead. What else?
Two things. Maybe that he basically said, I've done wrong. And
David.
I did it.
Yeah.
And now I've got choices. And now I don't like the choice I've got because all these people paying the consequences.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for these people.
Yeah.
So then the Lord stops.
All right. Why? When the Lord gave him three choices, and two of them were totally going to dump on the people and not have much to do with David at all. I mean, nobody in David's household got sick. And if there was a famine in the land for 7 months, David's family would have eaten. And one of them was, personally against David. And it looks like, well, gosh, if he would just man up and take that, that'd be good. But actually, the damages of him having to flee the capital again and all that sort of thing, that was not easy on people either. So why was it that God gave him three punishments which would fall heavy on the people? What do you think about that? I mean, doesn't that strike you as somehow or another not fair or something? David sinned.
He is king.
Yeah, but he's the king.
He will pay the price with his, the way the people feel about him, of course.
All right. Well, you're heading in the right direction.
Maybe he would have hurt you.
Huh?
Was his pride because of the people?
Well, it was pride. His pride was to know how many people he had. But yes, there was that. What else? Huh? Well, there's that. That hurts the parent. For the parent to see the kid go to prison, that's hard, right?
God maybe was testing him and giving him these choices and to see which one he would pick.
Well,
hurting the people or hurting himself.
So, which did he pick the right one?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
he did.
Why didn't he choose to let himself get bashed around? I mean, I've already given the answer, but... in other words, a person might say, well... Let David pay the price for his sin.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a natural sort of response. If they don't think about the ultimate consequences and realize that hurts the people too. If we send the father to prison, the children and the family suffer. Okay? So, anyways, the point that I want us to see here is that we get the government we deserve. What happens is when David decides to get all cocky and go out there and number the people, part of what he's doing is he's responding to the condition of the people. There's a reason why God tells us to pray for our leaders. And there's a reason why God tells us we're supposed to honor our leaders. And that's because very often what our leaders do is a reflection of our sin. Now, we like to sit here and throw bombs at Washington and say all those people are ugly and mean and snotty and all that stuff and they should go outside and eat worms. But the truth of the matter is that we have the government we deserve. That mess that we have in Washington, all that corruption, all that, we deserve it or else we wouldn't have it. And this is one of the classic biblical cases where you've got a good, godly man who's king. And yet, because of the general cultural milieu of wandering away from God, it reflects itself in the king. We get the government we deserve. And if we don't see this, then we're going to be constantly sitting back going, I wish someone would straighten those people in Washington out without realizing that they are a reflection of who we are. Now, a very simple way to prove that is, especially in our country, is we elect them. 51% of the people said, I want this guy. 51% of the people said, and sometimes it's 70 or 80% of the people, I want this guy. If the nation says, let there be righteousness, let there be this, let there, whatever, we get that kind of person. The kind of person who gets put in charge in our country, city government, county government, state government, you know, we, the city of Atlanta, as a people, they selected Kasim Reed to represent them. They are Kasim Reed. We get the government we deserve. Our own low-level greed and deception and corruption bubbles its way up to the top, and that our leaders become like that. Or else we wind up with leaders who are like that. So we have, maybe we're playing fast and loose with supplies at work. You know, maybe we're out slicking our neighbors or something in a business deal, or we're not straight upright like we should be. But it's low level stuff, you know. It's kind of like, and it's done all the time, you know. If you can out slick your neighbor, you know, whatever. For instance, there's a proverb that says, "Don't say it is bad, and then walk away and say it is good." And he's talking about a business deal. He's saying, don't go into a business deal and say, you know what, I think that horse is old, and I think it's, you know, broken down, and I think all this kind of stuff. I don't think it's worth but $50, you know. You know, and the guy's got a horse, he's got to sell it so he can eat. This horse is worth a bunch, and you know it's worth a bunch. And you're going, you know, I just don't think so. And then the guy turns over his horse for his $50 so his kids can eat. And you walk away and you go, ha, I got him. I slicked him. We have a whole culture right now, even in our business world, that is so corrupt, and we can't see it, but it's so corrupt that we get the business, we get the leadership we deserve. Let me give you an example, and I've been part of this most of my work career. We have an environment today where if you have a small company and they're trying to find access to cash so that they can grow their business, they go to some investment banker and they put together a proposal to go into the marketplace to go public. And in the proposal, they paint their company's chances and everything in the best they possibly can. Now, everybody knows that they're going to do as much lying as they can to make it look good. And so they're all, on the other hand, sitting there going, I'm out, and they're downsizing. There's this big battle about what truth is. And truth is somewhere in the middle. So, you know, some of these deals that go out are they're pretty close to fair, and others of them are just totally fraudulent. We got to a place back in the 70s when people were going public with stuff that wouldn't make money until maybe 10 years down the road. Y'all remember the dot-coms? And so they were going out saying to people, if you give us the money to do this, we'll be the next Microsoft and you'll be rich, but our projection is we won't earn a thing for 10 years. And people out of their greed were saying, yeah, but they could be the next Microsoft. Okay? And so then what happened is we flooded the market full of all these public companies who had no value, and then we had a collapse, just like we did with the housing market. We had the bubble busted on the dot-coms, and all the dot-com people, 80% of them went under. We were a dot-com company, but we actually had profit. We were actually making profit. And so when the dot-com thing crashed, it used to be MedSS.com. We just took the dot-com off because it was no longer a thing to do. But we actually had a profit. But 80% of them didn't and weren't going to for some time. Those things crashed, and all these investors who put their money in this because Wall Street said this is going to be the next Microsoft, all those people lost their money. And I can promise you, it wasn't big investment bankers who lost their money. Those people put the money into the deal so that it could take off, because somebody's got to facilitate the money. And then they sold to the common person on the street stock in this particular thing. And they, you know, they put the buzz out, this is going to be the next Microsoft or whatever. And they knew full well, very often, that it wasn't. But they said that because what happened is all the little Joe Schmoes went out and they put $100 in this and $1,000 in this, and pension funds put some of their money there and whatever. And so they went out and they bought all this stuff on the basis that the people who were supposed to know, they were supposed to trust, their bankers, misled them about all of this, and they put their money into it, and they went down. Because this thing went down, they went down. Now, the bankers never lose in this because they're out of it before that happens. They never lose. And the people who got the money to start up their business, they got the money to start up their business. So they were given $10 million on a promise. That's how that works. Okay. Then let's say that we have one of these deals where somebody goes out to go public and they've got a good product and it's got a good return to it and all that sort of thing. They're making a very honest projection about what we do, and they're not fabricating stuff. And I would tell you that that's the way we went out public several times. I've been out three times. And so it's honest stuff. I mean, there's a certain amount of window dressing on it, but everybody knows it's there, but you know, whatever. So, but it's basically, it's honest stuff. So what happens, it goes out and the people at Wall Street says, this is a pony we can ride a long way. So let's get behind this thing. We'll put $150 million in this. Then we'll go out and we'll sell it to Joe Schmo. And then we'll get our $150 million plus profit back, and we'll be out of the deal. Joe Schmo will take the risk. So what happens is you go out and you go public, and you do a good job. You're earning good money. You haven't lied to anybody, and everybody's getting return on their investment. Now, the projections were that it might go $24 or $50 or $100 a share. And what happens is very often it'll wind up at 18 or, you know, 19 or whatever. Sometimes it'll go up and then come back down. It just depends on how the business goes and all kinds of stuff. So anybody who's in business is a risk, period. Anybody is. But if you've got good management and if your projections were based on good principles and whatever, you're going to get out there, and at least for some period of time until realities change in the marketplace, you're going to be able to deliver what you promised. Now, there's all kinds of things that go into this. One of the things that people learned is that if you let these people who take this out, if you let them sell their stock, cash it in, and run away, then you've got all your management team that you were counting on is gone. And so they have rules out there. You have to, if you're an officer of one of these companies, you have to wait 8 quarters before you can sell. And that means that for 2 full years, you've got to be able to produce what you said you were going to, or everybody's going to get out of the stock. So you, and then when they get out of the stock, then you sell, you don't make as much money. So what happens is that they force the leadership, and these rules come into play because one guy does this and the next guy does this to fix it, and the next guy finds new mousetrap, new tricks. So they basically force the management team who made these promises to not win or not gain anything on them until they fulfilled them for at least 2 full years. So that's a good thing. I mean, it means that you've got that going for you. But there's always ways to kind of fluff the books a little bit. Like, for instance, let's say you have a quarter and you make a whole lot more than you thought you were going to in a quarter. Well, in the various rules of Wall Street, if you underproject or overproject, it's bad. So if you say we're going to make 10 cents a share and you make 20, that's bad, because Wall Street says you don't know what you're doing. Your projections didn't come anywhere near what actually happened. You don't know what you're doing. So what Wall Street, what they reward you for is being pretty close to your projections with a little bit of fluff. So what you do is you say, okay, we're going to make too much money this quarter. And so what you do is you take a bunch of debt that you've got or something like that, and you set it up in such a way that it no longer counts toward your profits. It's what we call hiding pennies. Okay. Then what happens is the next month you go, we're going to be short this month. So you go into that debt where you've hidden all that money and you declare it good, you bring it out, and all of a sudden those hidden profits are now being used. And it's a game that's played. Everybody knows it's being played, whatever. But the point is there's all this process. Now, so far we basically just have slick business. Now here's where I think God gets upset. What happens is we get out here in this marketplace And we're in this thing, and we've been in more than 2 years, whatever. And the stock has a certain value in it. Let's say that it's either not the value that you promised or that you should be delivering, because every quarter you're going to tell people what you think is going to next quarter, or it is, but the stockholders don't think it's enough. And so you've got, and you get all kinds of stuff like big stockholders who go in and leverage to, we want to get rid of the board and put some of our, get rid of the management, put our own people in here or whatever, because we think this thing ought to make more money. So what happens is that the company, in order to respond to these demands, either to get the stock up price where it is, in other words, to improve the performance so the stock is up there, or to improve the performance so that the stockholders who aren't going to fire them or whatever, and that's, I'm just being real simple, but the greed of the stockholders, they go, we've got to find a way to get more profit out of this. So what do? The biggest single item they have is payroll. So what they do is they decide to downsize the company. And they go out and they start laying people off. Now, if they're a company with some kind of conscience, they lay them off with a certain amount of severance, and a reasonable severance package. And if it's a marketplace in which jobs are easy to find, no big damage, although there's always an emotional damage when somebody loses their job. If you're in a place where jobs sort of can't be found, and that sort of thing, you put somebody in a position, you can damage those families for a long time to come. And they start downsizing, they start getting rid of people. And if you're a greedy company, you get rid of them and you don't give them any severance or nothing to live on or something. You go, here's 2 weeks' pay, you know. Well, it's going to take 2 years to get a job. Well, but here's 2 weeks' pay. You know, I mean, you know. So what happens is that the companies squeeze the workforce to get the workforce down so the profits come up to meet the expectations so that the stockholders, that's you and me, and you may not even know it because you may have a 401k and you're in a fund. So the stockholders, you and me, your funds are not being managed by you personally. You don't even pay attention. But you've hired Morgan Stanley to manage your funds. And Morgan Stanley's got to make sure they give you good results. And so they're pressuring all of this. And so what happens is we get people laid off all over this country. It goes into unemployment. People, you know, they suffer greatly for this. People kill themselves. Families are torn apart. All this sort of thing. And it all goes back to the greed of the population. If we were smart people, we would say to our companies, I don't need to make $25 a share. 24 is fine. Don't lay off people so that they suffer. Now, if you're a smart company, what you do is you don't hire more people than you need, because that way, when tough times come, you don't have to lay so many people off. But here's what happens. When they get to downsizing in this environment, and they start cutting people back, let's say maybe they want to sell the company, and they want to make the profits look really good for a year or so they can sell the company, and they just squeeze and they squeeze and they squeeze and they squeeze. And you know who's the model for this is Welch from General Electric. Nardelli was one of his disciples. The whole Home Depot thing is an example of what I'm talking about. It's an exact example of what I'm talking about. So they squeeze and they squeeze and they get it down. And what happens is the employees you have are now working twice as long for the same money. They're never home. They used to be able to maybe support their family by itself, but now the wife's got to go out. They're taking pay cuts. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on. The people who are now doing the work are being mangled in order that the profits would go up high enough so that the greedy public is going to get what it wants. Okay? So as when we look at this scenario, we can blame the people who took the stock out. We can blame the investment bankers because they set this all up. We can blame the management team because they ran it in such a way as to make the thing artificially look good when it really wasn't. We can blame the people who are pressuring the management team to do these kind of things. But where the blame falls is on those of us who buy those products and invest in those things, who are demanding cheaper stuff. We talk about is a simple thing. We talk about the fact that all of our businesses are fleeing to China for the cheaper labor and all that sort of thing. Well, the truth is it's a reflection of the general greed of the American population. If we were willing to pay more for something, and you have to remember now, we pay less for things than most of the world does very often. You know, you buy gas in Europe and it's $8 a gallon. So we have created a society in which we've driven down prices so that the American consumer feels like that, you know, so they're getting all this benefit. And we don't pay attention to the people cost, the damage to all the people. So when the housing market collapses, one of the reasons the housing market collapses is because somebody puts together a scheme that suggests that you can own a house that's four times as big as you need, the monthly payment is 70% of your take-home pay, and you know, or some ridiculous number, and that not only that, but you have a right to do that, and you know, and then you get the congressman to say, "I'm going to make it a law so that you can do all of that." The general greed of the American public is what drives all of this. We don't see the hue and cry for, you know, these people are getting thrown out of work and they need their work. Now, let's say that we got these people thrown out of work and we're lucky enough we still got jobs and all that sort of thing. The very least that we should do is to say, well, they're my responsibility to feed them because they got thrown out of work in order so that I could have a better economic life and they need help. And I tell you, when you notice this when the person who needs help is your son. And so all of a sudden you're writing checks for $1,000 a month to keep your son and his wife and your three grandchildren from losing their house or going hungry. You feel it then. But the truth is that people's sons all around you are in this particular mess. Now, I've gone a long way to say that we get the government we deserve, we get the economy we deserve. All of that is a reflection of who we are.
Yeah.
Us. Yeah, that's right. We've met the enemy and it is us. We've met the enemy and it is us. So, and then we play the blame game. It's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault. Those bankers, they ought to go to jail, whatever. Well, they should, but we haven't got enough cells. One of the things we're seeing in this story, this is just one of the numbers in the Bible like this, is the people of Israel are paying a price for the sin of their king. But their king is sinning largely because he's reflecting the righteousness or lack thereof of the people. If the people of Israel are righteous, they will not only encourage their king to be righteous, but require him to be righteous. David has this personal relationship with God, and frankly, that saved Israel a whole lot of grief. But David was not immune from sin. Now, I want to go back to something that I read. Because I don't want us to miss it. It said in page 190, the anger of the Lord burned against who? David?
Israel.
Israel. The very first line, it's very top. The anger, now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. God was unhappy with Israel. And the anger of the Lord incited David against them, saying, go and number Israel and Judah. Go down to Roman number 1. When a nation pleases the Lord, he gives them good leadership, and he gives their leadership wisdom on how to rule in such a way as to make the people's lives prosperous and happy. When a nation does not please the Lord, the opposite is true. God was again unhappy with Israel at this time, so he allowed / incited David to do a foolish thing, to number the people, to take a sentence, and even Joab knew it was wrong. Even Joab knew it was wrong. It was such a bonehead move. Even Joab knew it was wrong. All right, so when you look at that and you on the surface, our usual normal immediate response is to say, I got to quit. Our usual normal immediate response is to say, well, why is God picking on the people for something David did? I mean, look at the jerk. He's up there numbering the people, and you know, he's the king, and you know, he shouldn't be doing this. And that's the problem with Washington. They're always doing these stupid and immoral, corrupt things. We need to get those bums out and put some better people in. Those bums are a reflection of who we are. If 80% of us wanted righteousness, we would be electing 80%, we'd be electing righteous people. Even if 51% of us wanted righteousness, we'd be electing more righteous people. You see what I'm saying? And so we need to recognize, this is why we need to pray for our country. This is why we need to pray for our leadership, why we need to pray for our government, and it's why we need to pray that it starts with us. This is why. Because I can curse those people, revile them, do all kinds of things I'm not supposed to do. I can blame them. I can talk about how stupid they are, whatever. They are merely a reflection of who we are. And if we want revival to come in this country, if we want our children to have a better place, if we want our children's children to have a better place, we need to begin the process of personally improving or sanctifying ourselves and encouraging it in those around us who call themselves the people of God. God said in 2 Chronicles, when you go out into the land, you will prosper. I will prosper you, because it is the natural result of walking with God is we will prosper at some level. It may be that you have 3 sheep in Africa versus a guy who has 2 or none, but you're going to prosper. And he says, when my people get to where they no longer need me or seek me because of their prosperity, they don't feel their need for me anymore, and they start going their own way and doing their own things and maximizing their pleasures and everything like that, when they start doing all of that, they start chasing after hedonism, consumerism, all that kind of stuff, and they drift away not only from putting me first, but for caring for their neighbor. When they go away from that, he said, then what I will do is I will bring upon them a plague, a war, a famine, you know, this. I will bring a nation worse than themselves to discipline them until in their pain they cry out and say, where are you, God? And when they cry out and say, where are you, God? And they begin to look with honest hearts that are fed by pain, result, remorse, guilt, and they come to the conclusion, we did this to ourselves. Then he said, I will respond to them. If my people at that time, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked way, then I will hear from heaven and heal their land. Now, we quote that a lot, but that's what this is what that means. And this particular lesson tonight is it is a interesting lesson. It's in the Bible. It's one of the things you read it and you go, what's that all about? And it's not the only place that it ever happens in the scriptures. But it's trying to make a really important point that we need to see. And that is that the opportunity for us to ever be a good company, a country again, and have a good culture again, resides entirely in our own personal walk with the Lord and our ability to repent and ask God to change us. We can point to other people and say, look how bad they are. And we could be very accurate, but it's useless. It doesn't get us anywhere. It doesn't help to point out. Because if we get rid of this bum, we'll elect another one just like him. Because we're going to elect the same thing we elected before. We may think that because one party is taken over now versus another party that we're going to have, that's going to be a great blessing to this country. And it might if they operate out of a pure heart. But all it will probably mean is that we'll trade this kind of set of greed for that kind of set of greed. This kind of set of problems for that kind of set of problems. So this is a mono issue. If my country, my city, my state, or whatever, is corrupt and not walking right and whatever, there's the problem. I'm the problem. I and all the other people, all the other I's around here, the community, people in the community. One of the things that was interesting, and I'm going to shut up, but